He opened the packet. Dozens of grayed and yellowed sheets rustled dryly.
You see, I do not bother to deny it. I believe we should be open and frank with each other if anything is to come of this meeting.
Yes, a team of our advance scouts did find the pack horse in the ruins of Eugene. Yours, I imagine, whose saddlebags contained this very strange cargo. Ironically, I believe that at the very moment our scouts were seizing these samples, you were killing two of their comrades elsewhere in the deserted town.
Bezoar raised one hand before Gordon could speak.
I have no fear of retribution. Our wholeness philosophy does not believe in it. You defeated two survivalists in a straight fight. That makes you a peer in our eyes. Why do you think you were treated as men after you were captured and not gelded as serfs or as sheep?
Bezoar smiled amiably, but Gordon seethed inside. In Eugene last spring, he had seen what wholenists did to the bodies of the harmless gleaners they had mowed down. He remembered young Mark Egg's mother, who saved his life and her son's with one heroic gesture. Bezoar clearly meant what he said, yet to Gordon the logic was sickly, bitterly ironic. The bold survivalist spread his hands.
We admit to taking your mail, Mr. Inspector. Can we mitigate our guilt by claiming ignorance? After all, until these letters reached me here, none of us had ever heard of the restored United States. Imagine our amazement when we saw such things. Letters carried many miles from town to town, warrants for new postmasters, and these...
He raised the sheaf of official-looking flyers.
These declarations from the provisional government in St. Paul City.
The words were conciliatory and sounded earnest, but there was something in the man's tone of voice. He could not pin it down, but whatever it was disturbed Gordon.
You know of it now, he pointed out, and yet you continue. Two of our postal couriers have disappeared without a trace since your invasion to the north. Your American Liberation Army has been at war with the United States for many months now, Colonel Bezoar, and that cannot be mitigated by ignorance.
The lies came easily now. In essence, after all, the words were true. Ever since those few weeks, right after the big war had been won, when the U.S. still had a government and food and materiel still moved protected on the highways, the real problem had not been the broken enemies without, so much as the chaos within. Grain rotted in bulging silos while farmers were felled by simple, inoculable plagues. Vaccine was available in the cities, where starvation reaped multitudes. More people died due to the breakdown and lawlessness, the shattered web of commerce and mutual assistance, than from all the bombs and germs, or even from the three-year dusk. It had been men like this who delivered the coup de grace, who ended any chance those millions had.
Perhaps,
Bezoar tossed back a shot of the pungent liquor. He smiled.
Then again, many have claimed to be the true inheritors of American sovereignty. So your restored United States controls large areas and populations, and so its leaders include a few old farts who once bought elected office with cash and a television smile. Does that mean it is the true America?
For an instant, the calm, reasonable visage seemed to crack, and Gordon saw the fanatic within, unchanged except perhaps by deepening over the years. Gordon had heard that tone long ago in the radio voice of Nathan Holm, before the survivalist saint was hanged, and spoken by his followers ever since. It was the same solipsistic philosophy of ego that had stoked the rage of Nazism, of Stalinism. Hegel, Horbiger, Holm, the roots were identical. Derived truth, smug and certain, never to be tested in the light of reality. In North America, Holmism had been a nut fringe during a time of otherwise unparalleled brilliance, a throwback to the egoistic 80s. But another version of the same evil, Slavic mysticism, actually seized power in the other hemisphere. That madness finally plunged the world into the Doom War.
Gordon smiled with grim severity. Who can say what is legitimate after all these years? But one thing is certain, Bezoar. The true spirit of America seems to have become a passion for hunting down wholenists. Your cult of the strong is loathed,
Not only in the restored U.S., but almost everywhere I've traveled. Feuding villages will join forces on rumor of sighting one of your bands. Any man caught wearing surplus camouflage is hanged on sight.
He knew he had scored, Ben. The earringed officer's nostrils flared.
That's Colonel Bezoar, if you please, and I'll wager there are some areas where that's not true, Mr. Inspector. Florida, perhaps? And Alaska?
Gordon shrugged. Both states had gone silent the day after the first bombs fell. There had been other places, too, such as southern Oregon, where the militia had not dared enter, even in strength. Bezoar stood up and walked to a bookshelf. He pulled down a thick volume.
Have you ever actually read Nathan Hone?
He asked, his voice amiable once again. Gordon shook his head.
But, sir,
Bezoar protested,
how can you know your enemy without learning how he thinks? Please, take this copy of Lost Empire, Hone's own biography of that great man Aaron Burr. It just might change your mind. You know, I do believe, Mr. Krantz, that you are the sort of man who could become a Holeist. Often the strong need only have their eyes opened to see that they have been cozened by the propaganda of the weak, that they could have the world if only they stretched out their hands and took it.
Gordon suppressed his initial response and picked up the proffered book instead. It probably wouldn't be wise to provoke the man too far. After all, he could probably have both Northerners killed with a word.
All right. It might help pass the time while you arrange our transportation back to the Willamette,
he said quite calmly.
Yeah,
Johnny Stevens contributed, speaking for the first time.
And while you're at it, how about paying the extra postage it'll take to finish delivering that stolen mail we're going to take back with us?
Bezoar returned Johnny's cold smile, but before he could reply, they heard footsteps on the wooden porch of the former ranger station. The door opened, and in stepped three bearded men dressed in the traditional green and black fatigues. One of them, the shortest but easily the most imposing figure, wore only a single earring, but it glittered with large inset gems.
Gentlemen,
Bezoar said, standing up,
allow me to introduce Brigadier General Macklin, U.S. Army Reserve, uniter of the Oregon clans of Holm and commander of the American Forces of Liberation.
Gordon stood up numbly. For a moment he could only stare. The general and his two aides were among the strangest-looking human beings he had ever seen. There was nothing unusual about their beards or earrings, or the short string of shriveled trophies that each wore as ceremonial decorations, but all three men were eerily scarred, wherever their uniforms permitted view of their necks and arms. And under the faint lines left by some long-ago surgery, the muscles and tendons seemed to bulge and knot oddly. It was weird, and yet it occurred to Gordon that he might have seen something akin to it sometime in the past. He could not quite remember where or when, though. Had these men suffered from one of the post-war plagues? Super mumps, perhaps? Or some sort of thyroid hypertrophy? In a sudden recognition, Gordon knew that the biggest of Macklin's aides was the pug-ugly raider who had struck so quickly on the night of the ambush by the banks of the Coquille, knocking him to the ground with the punch of a bull before he could even begin to move. None of the men was of the newer generation of feudal survivalists, young toughs recruited all through southern Oregon. Like Bezoar, the newcomers were clearly old enough to have been adults before the Doom War. Time did not seem to have slowed them down any, however. General Macklin moved with a cat-like quickness that was intimidating to watch. He wasted no time in pleasantries. With a jerk of his head and a glance at Johnny, he made his wishes known to Bezoar. Bezoar pressed his fingers together.
Ah, yes. Mr. Stevens, if you would please accompany these gentlemen back to your, quarters? It appears the general wants to speak with your superior alone.
Johnny looked at Gordon. Obviously, if given the word, he would fight. Gordon quailed inwardly under the burden of that expression in the youth's eyes. Such devotion was something he had never sought, not from anybody.
Go on back, John, he told his young friend.
I'll join you later. The two hulking aides accompanied Johnny outside. When the door had closed and the footsteps receded into the night, Gordon turned to face the commander of the United Holmists. In his heart, he felt a powerful determination. There was no regret, no fear of hypocrisy here. If it was in him to lie well enough to bluff these bastards, he would do it. He felt full within his postman's uniform and got ready to give the best performance of his life.
"Save it,"
Macklin snapped. The dark-bearded man pointed a long, powerful hand at him.
"One word of that crap about a restored United States out of you, and I'll stuff your uniform down your frigging throat."
Gordon blinked. He glanced at Bezois and saw that the man was grinning.
"I am afraid I've been less than open with you, Mr. Inspector."
There was a clear lilt of sarcasm this time in Bezois's last two words. The Holmist colonel bent to open a drawer in his desk.
"When first I heard of you, I immediately sent out parties to trace your route backwards. But by the way, you are right that Holmism is not very popular in certain areas, at least not yet. Two of the teams never returned."
General Macklin snapped his fingers.
"Don't drag this out, Bezois. I'm busy. Call the jerk in."
Bezois nodded quickly and reached back to pull a cord on the wall, leaving Gordon wondering what he had been trying to find in the drawer.
"Anyway, one of our scouting parties did encounter a band of kindred spirits in the Cascades, in a pass north of Crater Lake. There were misunderstandings. Most of the poor locals died, I'm afraid. But we did manage to persuade a survivor."
There were footsteps, then the beaded curtain parted. The svelte, blonde woman held it open and watched coldly as a battered-looking man with a bandaged head stumbled into the room. He wore a uniform of patched, faded camouflage, a belt knife, and a single, tiny earring. His eyes were downcast. This survivalist was one who seemed less than joyous at being here.
"I would introduce you to our latest recruit, Mr. Inspector," Bezois said. "But I believe you two already know each other."
Gordon shook his head, thoroughly lost. What was going on here? To his knowledge, he had never seen this man before in his life. Bezois prodded the drooping newcomer, who looked up. Then,
"I cannot say for certain," the unsteady Holm recruit said, peering at Gordon. "He might be the one. It was a passing event, really, of so little consequence at the time."
Gordon's fists balled suddenly.
"That voice! It's you, you bastard!"
The jaunty alpine cap was gone, but now Gordon recognized the salt and pepper sideburns, the sallow complexion. Roger Septian seemed far less serene than when Gordon had last seen the man, on the slopes of a death-dry mountainside, helping to carry away nearly everything Gordon owned in the world, blithely, sarcastically leading him to almost certain death. Bezois nodded in satisfaction.
"You may go, Private Septian. I believe your officer has suitable duty arranged for you tonight."
The former robber and one-time stockbroker nodded wearily. He didn't even glance again at Gordon, but passed outside without another word. Gordon realized that he had blundered in reacting so quickly. He should have ignored the man, pretended he didn't recognize him. But then, would it have made a difference? Macklin had already seemed so sure.
"Get on with it,"
the general told his aide. Bezois reached into the drawer again, and this time drew forth a small, ragged black notebook. He held it out to Gordon.
"Do you recognize this? It has your name in it."
Gordon blinked. Of course it was his journal, stolen, along with all his goods, by Septian and the other robbers only hours before he stumbled onto the ruined postal van and started down the road to his new career. At the time, he had mourned its loss, for the diary detailed his travels ever since leaving Minnesota, 17 years ago, his careful observations of life in post-Holocaust America. Now, though, the slim volume was the last thing on earth he would ever have wanted to see. He sat down heavily, suddenly weary, aware of how completely the devils had been toying with him. The lie had caught up with him, at last. In all the pages of that little journal, there wasn't a single word about postman or recovery or any
Restored United States. There was only the truth. 13. Lost Empire by Nathan Holm.
Today, as we approach the end of the 20th century, the great struggles of our time are said to be between the so-called left and the so-called right, those great behemoths of a contrived, fictitious political spectrum. Very few people seem to be aware that these so-called opposites are in reality two faces to the same sick beast. There is a widespread blindness which keeps millions from seeing how they have been fooled by this fabrication. But it was not always so, nor will it always be. In other tracts I have spoken of other types of systems, of the honor of medieval Japan, of the glorious, wild American Indians, and of shining Europe during the period effete scholars today call its Dark Age. One thing history tells us over and over again. Throughout all eras, some have commanded while others have obeyed. It is a pattern of loyalty and power that is both honorable and natural. Feudalism has always been our way as a species ever since we foraged in wild bands and screamed defiance at each other from opposing hilltops. That is, it was always our way until men were perverted, the strong sapped by the whimpering propaganda of the weak. Think back to how things were when the 19th century was just dawning in America. Back then the opportunity stood stark and clear to reverse the sick trends of the so-called Enlightenment. The victorious Revolutionary War soldiers had expelled English decadence from most of the continent. The frontier lay open, and a rough spirit of individualism reigned supreme throughout the newborn nation. Aaron Burr knew this when he set out to seize the new territories west of the original 13 colonies. His dream was that of all natural males, to dominate, to conquer, to win an empire. What would the world have been like if he had won? Could he have prevented the rise of those misborn twin obscenities, socialism and capitalism? Who can tell? I will tell you, though, what I believe. I believe the era of greatness was at hand, ready to be born. But Burr was brought down before he could accomplish much more than the punishment of that tool of traitors, Alexander Hamilton. Superficially, his chief role would seem to have been Jefferson, the conniver who robbed him of the presidency, but in fact the conspiracy went far, far deeper than that. That evil genius, Benjamin Franklin, was at the heart of it. That cabal to kill the empire before it could be born. His instruments were many, too many even for a man as strong as Burr to fight. And the chiefest of those instruments was the Order of Cincinnatus.
Gordon slammed the book face down on the ground beside the straw tick. How could anyone have read crap like this, let alone published it? It was still light enough to read after the evening meal, and the sun was out for the first time in days. Nevertheless, a crawling chill ran up and down his back as the mad dialectic echoed within his head. That evil genius, Benjamin Franklin. Nathan Holm did make a good case that poor Richard had been much more than a clever printer-philosopher who played ambassador in between scientific experiments and wenching. If even a small fraction of Holm's citations were correct, Franklin certainly was at the center of unusual events. Something odd did happen after the Revolutionary War, something that somehow thwarted the men like Aaron Burr and brought about the nation Gordon had known. But beyond that, Gordon was impressed mostly with the magnitude of Nathan Holmes' madness. Fezwar and Macklin had to be completely crazy if they thought these ravings would convert him to their plans. The book had, in fact, just the opposite effect. If a volcano were to go off right here in Agnes, he felt it would be worth it to know this nest of snakes would go to hell along with him. Not far away, a baby was crying.
Gordon looked up, but could barely make out shabby figures moving beyond the nearby copse of alders. New captives had been brought in last night. They moaned and huddled close around the small fire they had been allowed, not raiding even the shelter of a roofed pen. Gordon and Johnny could be joining those miserable serfs soon if Macklin did not get the answer he wanted. The general was losing patience. After all, from Macklin's point of view, his offer to Gordon must have seemed quite reasonable. Gordon had only a little while left in which to make up his mind. The Holmist offensive would begin again with the first thaw, with or without his compromised cooperation. He did not see where he had much choice. Unbidden, a memory of Dina came to mind. He found himself missing her, wondering if she was still alive, wishing he could touch her and be with her, pestering questions and all. By now, of course, it was probably too late to stop whatever crazy scheme she and her followers had dreamed up. Gordon frankly wondered why Macklin had not already gloated to him over yet another disaster to the hapless army of the Willamette.
Perhaps it's only a matter of time, he thought gloomily.
Johnny finished rinsing out the nub-worn toothbrush that was their sole common possession. He sat next to Gordon and picked up the Burr biography. The youth read for a while, then looked up, clearly puzzled.
I know our school at Cottage Grove wasn't much by pre-war standards, Gordon, but Grandfather used to give me lots to read and talk to me a lot about history and stuff. Even I know this guy Holden is making up half this junk. How did he get away with pushing a book like this? How is it anyone ever believed him?
Gordon shrugged. It was called the big lie technique, Johnny. Just sound like you know what you're talking about, as if you're citing real facts. Talk very fast. Weave your lies into the shape of a conspiracy theory and repeat your assertions over and over again. Those who want an excuse to hate or blame, those with big but weak egos, will leap at a simple, neat explanation for the way the world is. Those types will never call you on the facts. Hitler did it brilliantly. So did the mystic of Leningrad. Holm was just another master of the big lie.
And what about you?
Gordon asked himself. Did he, inventor of the fable of the restored United States, collaborator in the hoax of Cyclops, have any right to cast stones? Johnny read on for a few minutes more. Then he tapped the book again.
Who was this Cincinnatus guy, then? Did Holm make him up, too?
Gordon lay back on the straw, his eyes closed.
And, if I remember right, he was a great general of ancient Rome back in the days of the Republic. According to the legend, he got sick of fighting one day and retired from the army to farm his land in peace.
One day, though, emissaries came out from the city to see him. Rome's armies were en route. Their leaders had proven incompetent. Disaster seemed inevitable. The delegation approached Cincinnatus. They found him behind his plow, and they pleaded with him to take command of the last defense.
What did Cincinnatus tell the guys from Rome?
Oh, well, Gordon yawned. He agreed, all right. Reluctantly. He rallied the Romans, beat the invaders, and drove them all the way back to their own city. It was a great victory.
I'll bet they made him king or something, Johnny suggested.
Gordon shook his head. The army wanted to. The people also. But Cincinnatus told them all they could go chase themselves. He returned to his farm and never left it again.
Johnny scratched his head. But why did he do that? I don't get it.
Gordon did, though. He understood the story completely, now that he thought about it. He had had the reasons explained to him not so very long ago, and he would never forget.
Gordon?
He did not answer. Instead, he turned over at a faint sound from outside. Looking through the slats, he saw a party of men approaching up the trail from the river docks. A boat had just come ashore. Johnny seemed not to have noticed yet. He persisted in his questions, as he had ever since they had recovered from their capture. Like Dina, the youth never seemed willing to lose any opportunity to try to improve his education.
Rome was a long time before the American Revolution, wasn't it, Gordon? Well, then, what was this?
He picked up the book again.
This Order of Cincinnatus. Holm talks about here.
Gordon watched the procession approach the jail pen. Two serfs labored with a stretcher, guarded by khaki-clad survivalist soldiers. George Washington founded the Order of the Cincinnati after the Revolutionary War, he said absently. His former officers were the chief members. He stopped as their guards stepped over and unlocked the gate. They both watched as the serfs entered and laid their burden on the straw. They and their escorts turned and left without another word.
He's hurt pretty bad, Johnny said when they hurried over to examine the injured man. This compress hasn't been changed in days.
Gordon had seen plenty of wounded men in the years since his sophomore class had been drafted into the militia. He had learned a lot of bush diagnosis while serving with Lieutenant Vann's platoon. A glance told him that this fellow's bullet wounds might have healed eventually with proper treatment, but the smell of death now hung over the still figure. It rose from limbs suppurated with marks of torture.
I hope he lied to them,
Johnny muttered as he labored to make the dying prisoner comfortable. Gordon helped fit their blankets around him. He was puzzled over where the fellow had come from. He did not look like a Willameter, and unlike most Camas and Roseburg men, he had obviously been clean-shaven until recently. In spite of his ill treatment, there was too much meat on his bones for him to have been a serf. Gordon stopped suddenly, rocking back on his haunches. His eyes closed and opened. He stared.
Johnny, look here, is this what I think it is?
Johnny peered where he pointed, then pulled back the blankets for a better view.
Well, I'll be. Gordon, this looks like a uniform.
Gordon nodded. A uniform, and clearly one of post-war making. It was colored and cut totally unlike anything the Holmists wore, or for that matter, anything either of them had ever seen in Oregon before. On one shoulder, the dying man wore a patch embroidered with a symbol Gordon recognized from long ago. A brown grizzly bear striding upon a red stripe, all against a field of gold. A while later, word arrived that Gordon was wanted again. The usual escort came for him by torchlight. That man in there is dying, he told the head guard. The taciturn, three-earing Holmes shrugged. So? Woman's coming to tend him. Now move, General's waiting. On their way up the moonlit path, they encountered a figure coming down the other way. The slope-shouldered drudge stepped aside and waited for the men to pass, eyes downcast to the tray of rolled bandages and unguents she held. None of the aloof guards seemed to notice her at all. At the last moment, however, she looked up at Gordon. He recognized the same small woman with gray-streaked brown hair, the one who had taken and repaired his uniform some days back. He tried to smile at her as they passed, but it only seemed to unnerve her. She ducked her head and scuttled back into the shadows. Saddened, Gordon continued up the path with his escort. She had reminded him a little of Abby. One of his worries had to do with his friends back in Pineview. The Holmes scouts who discovered his journal had come very close to the friendly little village. It wasn't only the frail civilization in the Willamette that was in terrible danger. Nobody anywhere was safe anymore, he knew, except, perhaps, George Powhatan, living safe atop Sugarloaf Mountain, tending his bees and beer while the rest of what was left of the world burned.
I'm getting tired of your stalling, Krantz, General Macklin told him when the guards had left the book-lined former ranger station. You put me in a hard position, General. I'm studying the book Colonel Bezoir lent me, trying to understand. Cut the crap, will you?
Macklin approached until his face was 2 feet from Gordon's. Even looking upward, the Holmist's strangely contorted visage was intimidating.
I know, men, Krantz. You're strong, all right, and you'd make a good vassal. But you're all mucked up with guilt and other civilized poisons. So much so that I'm beginning to think maybe you'll be useless after all.
The implication was direct. Gordon forced himself not to show the weakness in his knees.
You can be the Baron of Corvallis, Francis, a senior lord in our new empire. You can even hold on to some of your quaint, old-fashioned sentiments if you want, and if you're strong enough to enforce them. You want to be nice to your own vassals? You want post offices? We might even find a use for that restored United States of yours.
Macklin gave Gordon a toothy, odorous smile.
That's why only Charlie and I know about that little black journal of yours, until we can check the idea out.
It's not because I like you, understand. It's because we'd benefit a little if you cooperated. You might rule those techs in Corvallis better than any of my boys could. We might even decide to keep that Cyclops machine going if it paid its keep.
So the wholeness hadn't yet pierced the legend of the great computer. Not that it mattered much. They never had really cared about technology, except what was necessary to make war. Science benefited everyone too much, especially the weak.
Macklin picked up the fireplace poker and slapped it into his left palm.
The alternative, of course, is that we'll take Corvallis anyway, this spring. Only if we have to do it our way, it'll burn. And there won't be no post offices anywhere, boy. No smart-ass machines.
With the poker, Macklin reached out and touched a sheet of paper on the desk. A pen and ink pot lay next to it. Gordon well knew what the man expected of him. If all he had to do was agree to the scheme, Gordon would have done so at once. He would have played along until he had a chance to make a break for it. But Macklin was too canny. He wanted Gordon to write to the council in Corvallis, convincing them to surrender several key towns as an act of good faith before he would be released. Of course, he had only the general say-so that he would be made Baron of Corvallis after that. He doubted Macklin's word was any better than his own.
"Perhaps you don't think we're strong enough to take your pathetic Army of the Willamette without your help,"
Macklin laughed. He turned to the door.
"John!"
Macklin's burly bodyguard was in the room so swiftly and smoothly it seemed almost a blur. He closed the door and marched up to the general, snapping stiffly to attention.
"I'm going to let you in on something, Krantz. Sean and I, and that mean cat who captured you, are the last of our kind."
Macklin confided. It was really hush-hush stuff.
But you might have heard some of the rumors. The experiments led to some special fighting units, unlike any ever known before.
Gordon blinked. Suddenly it all made sense. The general's uncanny speed, the tracery of scars under his skin and his two aides.
"Augments."
Macklin nodded.
"Smart boy. You paid attention good for a college kid weakening his mind with psychology and ethics."
"We all thought they were only rumors."
"You mean they really took soldiers and modified them so..."
He stopped, looking at the strangely knotted muscles along Sean's bare arms. As impossible as it seemed, the story had to be true. There was no other rational explanation.
"They tried us out for the first time in Kenya, and the government did like the results in combat, oh. But I guess they weren't too happy with what happened after peace broke out and they brought us home."
Gordon stared as Macklin held out the poker to his bodyguard, who took one end, not in his massive fist, but between two fingers and a thumb. Macklin took the other end in a similar grip. They pulled. Without even breathing hard, Macklin kept talking.
"The experiment went on through the late 80s and early 90s. Special forces, mostly. They chose gung-ho types like us. Naturals, in other words."
The steel poker did not rock or shake. Almost totally rigid, it began to stretch.
"Oh, we tore up those Cubans good," Macklin chuckled, looking only at Gordon. "But the army didn't like how some of the vets acted when the action ended, and we all went home. They were afraid of Nate Holm, you see, even then. He appealed to the strong, and they knew it.
The augmentation program was cut off. The poker turned dull red in the middle. It had stretched to half again its former length when it began to neck and shred like pulled taffy. Gordon glanced quickly at Charles Bezoar, standing beyond the two augments. The wholeness colonel licked his lips nervously, unhappily. Gordon could tell what he was thinking. Here was strength he could never hope for. The scientists and the hospitals where the work had been done were long gone. According to Bezoar's religion, these men had to be his masters. The tips of the torn poker separated with a loud report, giving off friction heat that could be felt some distance away. Neither of the enhanced soldiers even rocked.
"That'll be all, Sean."
Macklin threw the pieces into the fireplace as his aide swiveled smartly and marched out of the room. The general looked at Gordon, archly.
"Do you doubt any longer we'll be in Corvallis by May, with or without you? Any of the unaugmented boys in my armory are equal to 20 of your fumble-bum farmers, or your zany women soldiers."
Gordon looked up quickly, but Macklin only talked on.
"But even if the sides were more equal, you still wouldn't have a chance. You think we few augments couldn't slip into any of your strong points and level them at will? We could tear your silly defenses to pieces with our bare hands. Don't you hesitate to believe it, or even a second."
He pushed forward the writing paper and rolled the pen toward Gordon. Gordon stared at the yellowed sheet. What did it matter? In the midst of all these revelations, he felt he knew where things stood. He met Macklin's eyes. "I'm impressed." "Really? That was a convincing demonstration. Tell me, though, General, if you're so good, why aren't you in Roseburg right now?" As Macklin reddened, Gordon gave the wholeness chieftain a faint smile. "And while we're on the topic, who is it who's chasing you out of your own domain? I should have guessed before why you're pushing this war so hard and fast, why your people are staging their serfs and worldly possessions to move north en masse. Most barbarian invasions used to start that way, back in history, like dominoes toppled by other dominoes. Tell me, General, who's kicking your ass so bad you have to get out of the rogue?" Macklin's face was a storm. His knotted hands flexed and made white hard fists. At any moment, Gordon expected to pay the ultimate price for his deeply satisfying outburst. Barely in control, Macklin's eyes never left Gordon.
"Get him out of here," he snapped at Bezoar.
Gordon shrugged and turned away from the seething augment.
"And when you get back, I want to look into this, Bezoar. I want to find out who broke security."
Macklin's voice pursued his intelligence chief out onto the steps, where the guards fell in behind them. Bezoar's hand on Gordon's elbow shook all the way back to the jail pen.
"Who put this man here?"
the wholeness colonel shouted as he saw the dying prisoner on the straw tick between Johnny and the wide-eyed woman. One guard blinked.
"Isterman, I think. He just got in from the Salmon River front."
The Salmon River front? Gordon recognized the name of a stream in Northern California.
"Shut up!"
Bezoar nearly screamed, but Gordon had his confirmation. There was more to this war than they had known before this evening.
"Get him out of here! Then go bring Isterman to the big house at once!"
The guards moved quickly.
"Hey, take it easy with him!"
Johnny cried as they grabbed up the unconscious man like a potato sack. Bezoar favored him with a withering glare. The wholeness colonel took out his anger by kicking at the drudge woman, but her instincts were well honed. She was out the door before he connected.